Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. And you can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Eric Schlosser, an author and investigative journalist, the author of Fast Food Nation, and I will be moderating this evening's very distinguished panel. This program is part of the Food Lit series, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And it's the kickoff to the Commonwealth Club's How We Eat platform series, an in-depth look at our eating habits, health, and the mechanisms surrounding how we get our food. Now, those of you who saw the ad in the paper this morning might have thought the discussion this evening would be, is slow food boring? Well, that's like asking, is good sex boring? So we're not going to spend any time whatsoever on that question. It's a pretty obvious answer. Slow food is anything but boring. Tonight we're going to talk about a different, and I think a very important issue. We're going to talk about the health and well-being of this country's children and what we can do about it. Right now, we have a health disaster unfolding among America's children, and it's tragic. It's absolutely tragic. The obesity rate among preschoolers has doubled in the last 30 years. The obesity rate among children aged 6 to 11 has tripled, and this is unprecedented in our history. Tonight, our panelists are Alice Waters, the founder of the Chez Panisse restaurant, the founder and president of the Chez Panisse Foundation, author, sustainable food advocate, hellraiser, a great American. Anya Furneaux, Anya Furneaux, executive director of Slow Food Nation, which will be in San Francisco over Labor Day weekend. Harold Goldstein, the executive director of the California Center for Public Health Advocacy, and Dr. Bertram Lubin, who is president of the Children's Hospital Oakland Research Institute. And I'm going to start out by asking Dr. Lubin a question. And I'm wondering, just in the years that you have been practicing, in the years that you've been taking care of the health of children, what changes have you seen from the days that you were in med school in terms of the health of children in the Bay Area?
Well, Eric, I appreciate being asked this question, and I appreciate the opportunity to address this remarkable audience on this extremely important issue related to the health of children and the health of the future of our society. So I have seen, and I've been at Children's Hospital in Oakland for 31 years. I grew up in the East Coast, and I trained in pediatrics at Philadelphia and in Boston, and then returned to the University of Pennsylvania, and then moved to Oakland 31 years ago, primarily because of the diversity in the patient population and the opportunity to serve children that came from underserved backgrounds. I've seen some tragedies occur in relationship to nutrition and obesity in this group of children. Unfortunately, the system that we now have benefits those who are hospitalized rather than preventing illness. The system that we have that reimburses doesn't reimburse for preventive medicine. It doesn't address the fact that obesity not only causes immediate problems, social, medical, and otherwise, but causes long-term problems such as diabetes, hypertension, cardiovascular disease. We see approximately 100 new children every year diagnosed with diabetes, and the majority of these children, especially those with type 2, are obese. We see children, 30% of the children that we service have measurements that would put them in a very obese range. Many of them don't have quality food at home. Most of them don't have an opportunity to get any exercise, and most of them don't have any type of resources to address this. So things have gotten dramatically worse, and they're continuing to do so, and the systems that we have in place now don't begin to address any of the needs that our children have.
Thank you. Harold, if you listen to the food industry on this issue, their argument would be this is all about personal responsibility and parental responsibility. What you don't hear much about is the notion of corporate responsibility. And the phrase that you rarely hear about is the field that you have great expertise in, which is public health. And I'm wondering what a public health approach to these issues looks like.
It's a great question. We at the California Center for Public Health Advocacy have been dedicated for the last 10 years to changing public policies related to food and physical activity, specifically for California's children. There's a great book out. It's been out for a while, called Mindless Eating by Brian Wansink, that I would recommend reading after reading Eric Schlosser's two books and all of Alice Waters' books.
He is not my literary agent, nor is he a paid representative.
Brian Wansink, at the time, was the head of the Cornell Food Lab. So what he did all day, every day, was research on what it is that influences people's eating behaviors. And he starts his book with this quote. He says, "Everyone, every single one of us, eats how much we eat because of what's around us, and we're almost never aware of that." So if we think of what it is that's around us, who is it that determines what's around us? Now, to some extent, we have some personal responsibility. Personal responsibility is very important. We go to the supermarket and decide what we're going to buy. But do you decide if you have a supermarket in your neighborhood? Do you decide what kind of foods and beverages are in your supermarkets? In many low-income neighborhoods in California, there are as many as 5 or 6 or 7 times the number of fast food stores and convenience stores as there are grocery stores or other produce vendors. In California, the average is 4 times. So for all of us, we walk out of our door and there are 4 times as many unhealthy places as there are healthy places. Who is it that determines that? We all do. We just don't realize it. That's a matter of public policy. Yeah? Who is it that decides what kind of foods are sold in public schools? Up until 5 or 6 years ago, had never been a discussion about why it was that public schools in California and across the country had become soda and junk food superstores. And what did it take to change that? In 2005, Governor Schwarzenegger signed legislation to get soda and the worst of the junk food out of schools. How long did that take? 6 years. Who was it that was fighting against that? The soda and junk food industry. Where did they get their money to fight that? By selling a lot of soda and junk food. Yeah? So the food system is a highly political system. The folks with a lot of money, by selling the kinds of food that are so commonly available in California and across the country, are able to use their financial and political power to all too often design public policies, influence public policies in ways that are quite detrimental to the public's health.
Thank you. And Anya, who is bringing Slow Food Nation to San Francisco, I'm interested in hearing from you about other cultures and their relationship to food and how that connects to the slow food movement and Slow Food Nation. I mean, isn't it true that there still are cultures where children are not routinely given chicken McNuggets on a regular basis.
It's very true. And in Slow Food Nation, we're working to begin a consumer advocacy movement that's looking to create a more holistic approach to food, which means that food culture is maintained in a way that celebrates food, that healthful food is really the focus of many traditional cultures' lives. And if you look at where we are right now in America, we see a food system that's in crisis, a food system that's making people more sick than it is healing them. So looking at traditional cultures and also just food cultures that are more intact, then in America it's a way to inspire some of the messages around Slow Food Nation. But more specifically, I want to talk about the slow food movement globally because one of the major projects of Slow Food has been to, I guess, really kind of up the sex appeal or up the appeal in general of maintaining a more holistic understanding of food and celebrating the traditional ways that people have evolved with our food. So if you look at most traditional cultures' approach to food, you'll see that they're growing things that are environmentally responsible because they don't have the inputs to put into them that would make them bad for the environment. They're growing things that really use their natural resources well. They're growing things that their ancestors have been eating for generations and that are keeping them healthy. And they're also prioritizing food. And more often than spending money on food, they're spending time on food. So when we're looking at what can we change in America to make our system less sick, we want to think about making a global change about our understanding of the role of food in our lives. So often we're taking pot shots at little pieces of what's wrong. And with Slow Food Nation, we're trying to create a moment where there's a big enough momentum, a big enough movement to create a bigger change and to create policy that is really much more global. We're also looking at creating more than a political change, and that's a big part of it, but a change at an individual level around prioritizing food and spending more time on food. So if you know, thinking about some of the signs about how traditional cultures are also subsumed in American cultures, it's very interesting to look at immigration from Central America. I'm sure that you're very familiar with this data. But the obesity rates triple in the second generation compared to the first generation when people move to America from food cultures that are more holistic. So it's if you look at some of these combinations of food, I know from my personal experience going up to Sweden to visit the Suavas producers, which is a traditional cured meat made from reindeer. And what I learned there, it's an indigenous people, Lap people or Sami people, and their diet is entirely based on reindeer and wild gathered foods. And much like the Native American experience here in America, when they switch to a more common or more sort of mainstream Swedish diet, all of their health variables start to go really crazy. And so what we did with Slow Food was actually work to market their product in their own community, but also bring them into other contexts where their food was celebrated by a sort of a more gourmet or more kind of food-aware community. In the way that it was important was just raising the profile in their own community, because so often traditional food cultures aren't, they're looking always to change and to adapt to what's new and what's appealing. And it's so interesting to me now in Slow Food Nation, we've been planning this event for about a year, and we're going to be, I hope, really taking over San Francisco with this incredible celebration of the joys of food. And when I talk to many of my collaborators and the many people that we're working with, they'll talk about how when they're from a new immigrant culture or their first generation, they were so eager to eat the fast food. That was just exactly what they wanted to do, and it wasn't until adulthood that they went back to a different system and they rediscovered it. And it's very interesting to me now looking at how those same people who are coming back to it are battling with the struggle of, you know, is this food something that's just for a few privileged people, or is it American to love to eat this way? Is it American to enjoy food? We, as a culture, you know, looking at my experience working with Slow Food in Italy as well, I identify with the sort of Anglo-Saxon struggle with embracing food as being part of, a pleasurable life. And if you look at, for example, the nutrition guidelines in Britain, the number one thing on the list of what their equivalent of the food pyramid is enjoy what you eat and celebrate what you eat. And that is the place that we're hoping to go with Slow Food Nation in the long term, is to reprioritize the joy of food, reprioritize the pleasures of breaking bread at the table with your family, reprioritize planting a garden with your friends, making those the values that our food culture embraces, and making those the values that are more important than convenience and in this culture where we're eating, you know, 1 in 5 meals in our car. If you look at kind of the American food trajectory of the past 30, 40 years, we've sort of, you know, begun to outsource our food to corporations, and now we're really beginning to pay the price for it. We have a prioritized convenience above all other assets. And so looking at Slow Food Nation's impact and the what we want to impart every single person who comes to this event will take away, I'm hoping, is a sense of beginning to celebrate food, beginning to honor food in their lives, and also looking to learn from a more holistic understanding of food that we can see in so many other cultures.
Thank you. And Alice, as I listen to that and I think about this city being taken over for a weekend for Slow Food, and I think about the movement surrounding food that's really growing in this country, it's one of the few movements for social change that has tremendous energy at the moment. And I think about being seated right next to the person who really launched it. And it must be so gratifying, because these are things that you've been saying for so many years, and I think, you know, we're teased about originally, we're considered too radical and off to the side, and now, you know, you see mainstream restaurant chains borrowing some of these slogans and trying to co-opt them. And it must be very gratifying, and yet at the same time, I'd love to ask you about the work you're doing for children's health and the whole notion of edible education, and creating a food culture very early on in a child's life so that these problems never come later.
Well, I really had an edible education when I first went to France when I was 19. And I was very lucky to be there at a time when people went to the marketplace every day to buy what was fresh and what was delicious, and they brought it back and they ate with their families and friends. And in each neighborhood there were marketplaces and bakeries, and it was just like a little community that where food was woven into everyday life. It wasn't out here in the place of health and fueling up, but it was completely connected to what was growing at that moment in time. And you just didn't have tomatoes except a couple of months out of the year. And I had that sort of sense of aliveness of food, and I just completely fell in love. And when I came back to Berkeley, I just said, I want to live like this. I really want to live like this. And so I started cooking, and I was very lucky to find the right cookbooks of Elizabeth David and people who really were caring about food because of the way that it tasted, and it connected you to a table of friends and to the bigger world out there. And so that was the mission of the restaurant, was to produce this kind of food, and I couldn't find it. You know, I used to buy a big box of green beans and search through for the little tiny haricot vert, and they didn't exist. I called them haricot vert, but they were little tiny immature Kentucky Wonder beans. And we threw the rest of it out. And I wasn't looking for organic, local producers. I wasn't looking to eat in this season. I was looking for tasty food, for ripe food. And then I ended up at the doorstep of all of these producers. And we started buying from them directly. And we gave our money to these people, and we began to think of this as a way to support these people who were taking care of the land. And when we had this idea of thinking about how we were going to change the whole food system so that we were really taking care of the people who were producing the food, the idea of the public school system was just the only place to go. It's the only institution in this country that touches every single child every day. And so if you could put a curriculum into the school, if you could feed every child and bring them into a new relationship to food that was based on taste and pleasure, rather than don't eat this, that's not good for you. You know, that you could really bring them into a new set of values. And so that's the experiment that we've been working on called the Edible Schoolyard for the last 12 years. And we have found that when children grow food, when it's an interactive program, when they grow it and they're involved in the preparation of the food, they all eat it. And we're talking about, you know, garlic and chard and vegetables. We are only serving vegetables, as a matter of fact, and grains. And it's an amazing thing. They also like this program. They like working in the garden. They like touching these things. And while they're exploring the garden with their math class or their science class, they're tasting and they're eating those raspberries and they're learning which ones are ripe and which ones aren't ripe. They're learning what the compost heap is all about. They're learning this information osmosis. And that's what we need to learn to live together on this planet, to take care of the planet. We need to learn to be stewards of the land. We need to learn how to feed ourselves, understand the consequences of every decision. And as Bert was saying, you know, we think that these are personal, you know, decisions we make about food, but they have a public consequence. We are paying for the health, the unhealthy children. Our health cost is rising. We're paying for people to be unwell and not to take care of the environment. So we need to teach everyone. We need to teach everyone on the planet what the consequences are, and that's what edible education is all about.
Thank you. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Tonight we're discussing how we eat in America and some of the consequences. With me here tonight, I'm Eric Schlosser, is Alice Waters, founder of Chez Panisse Restaurant, Anya Furneaux, executive director of Slow Food Nation, Harold Goldstein, executive director of the California Center for Public Health Advocacy, and Dr. Bertram Lubin, president of the Children's Hospital Oakland Research Institute. One of the reasons I like being on a panel with Harold is it's good to be with someone that is hated even more by the junk food and the fast food industry than I am. So if there's going to be, you know, any trouble, I think it's going to head in his direction. And Harold, I want to ask you, I know that you're involved in this battle right now to get menu labeling in the state of California. And do you see a way to get these companies to profit from selling healthy food as opposed to what they're doing right now, which is profiting enormously by creating bad habits and selling food that can make you unhealthy?
Just the prospect of being hated more by the fast food industry than Eric Schlosser is one that kind of takes my breath away.
But, it's an honor.
So menu labeling is really it's pretty much the hot food issue in Sacramento these days. For the last 2 years, this is the second year that there's been a bill sponsored by our organization and the American Heart Association, the American Cancer Society, that would, for the first time in California, do what is now already done in New York, post calorie information on menu boards in chain restaurants and provide even more detailed information, calories, fat, saturated fat, salt, and the like, carbohydrates, on menus, so that when we eat out, we now spend 50% of our food dollars eating out. The food industry was successful in being exempted from the nutrition labeling laws that apply to all the packaged foods that you buy in grocery stores. So here's this piece of legislation: provide people with the information they need so that they can take personal responsibility, all of us, when we eat out. The restaurant industry obviously doesn't like this at all. Instead, their suggestion is, and this is their, they've come around to this, is to provide nutrition information in brochures. So I've brought an example of a brochure. This is the Jack in the Box brochure. This is how I'm imagining the Jack in the Box would like to provide nutrition information to all of us. So when you open it up, those of you on the radio can't see, but it's big. So here's the nutrition information. It starts with something called how it's stacked. How it's stacked means in your Asian chicken salad, what's the order that the food is piled onto your salad? And if you notice, it starts with salad. How many people are going to? And then you get all the ingredients. Now, those of you in the audience can actually see where the nutrition information is. It's a kind of a magic trick. You all can see it, but I can't because the nutritional information is on the back of the brochure. I don't even know it's there. And at the bottom of the page that doesn't have the nutritional information, it says, "We hope this nutritional information will help you satisfy your dietary needs." Here at Jack in the Box, I haven't found any nutritional information yet because I didn't even know to turn it over. And now you can see, those of you who aren't here
on the radio, it's don't
do
very
this at home.
Little numbers.
This is an Excel spreadsheet with, I would guess, 12, 14 columns and 100 rows in font that's small enough that now that I'm getting older, I would need glasses to read, right? So I imagine that what the fast food industry wants is for all of us to make sure that we do bring our reading glasses when we eat out and stand in line and read the information to find out, for example, at Starbucks, that you could get easily 1,000 calories by getting a mocha and a sugar cookie. 1,000 calories. In New York City, where they now have this information, they're calling it calorie sticker shock because, oh my gosh, that sugar cookie has 420 or 480 calories, right? One of the things to remember in this whole obesity epidemic is that 100 calories a day translates to 10 pounds a year. Yeah? So that if you eat a Cinnabon that has, I think, a little more than 1,100 calories, you've blown your diet the whole week. You're up 160 calories each day for the week just by eating a Cinnabon, right? So the question is, can the fast food industry make money selling healthy, affordable food? Absolutely they can. I mean, that's what the free market is about. Those industries that are going to be able to provide delicious, healthy, lower calorie food that meets some of those has some of those characteristics that we're talking about tonight, those are the fast food industries that are going to thrive. And those that continue providing nutritional information on brochures like this and continue to sell those kinds of foods that are contributing so much to this epidemic, as a result of just the basic free market, they're not going to do as well. And in that way, the free market could support all of us in being healthier.
Thank you. And Bert, there's something that you said earlier that's resonated with me. On the one hand, we have these companies that are profiting enormously by making the public unhealthy, and simultaneously we now have a healthcare system that finds it more profitable to do something like bariatric surgery on someone that's obese than to prevent someone from becoming obese. How do we turn around the economic incentives in healthcare so that these hospitals have a real interest in keeping you from ever needing that bariatric surgery?
Eric, thank you very much for asking that question, because I think that from a pediatric standpoint and from a pediatrician standpoint, this is at the heart of the problem. We have a system that doesn't reimburse for preventive measures. We have a system that reimburses the hospital and the doctors, and I'm not talking about the prices and the cost of healthcare, but it really doesn't address preventing illness. So malnutrition, which is poor nutrition as far as I'm concerned, results in developmental delay. We see now in Oakland rickets. Rickets is seen in children in Oakland. We have a whole program where we're seeing a number of cases a year, and that reflects vitamin D deficiency at a level probably far greater than that. We do believe that chronic illness and increased susceptibility to cancer and issues related to health disparities have a great deal to do with nutrition and nutritional education. And so I think we have to really all act as being responsible citizens to do something to change this direction. And hopefully, as our government changes, this will be a priority.
Thank you. And I'm going to start going to some of the questions that the audience has submitted, but I just want to ask Alice very quickly, was there a time in recent years when you despaired that these ideas and that this sort of movement would ever enter the mainstream, or did you just know it all along?
I believe in the power of delicious food and a community of friends and the rituals of the table. I believe in that so much that if you could get people connected, that it would change their way of thinking and their way of buying. And because I think that, this is our common language, is food. Everyone eats every day. So that those decisions that we make, they're really about our pleasure of how we live our lives every day. And they can be about taking care of the planet, and they can be about the restoration of our communities. And it's so amazing. And about our good health, which is the outcome of making these good decisions. And so this is not a difficult thing to do. This is a really a rewarding and exciting possibility that we have every day. And that's why I believe that if you build the school system, this program in the schools, and you create the criteria for buying the food for the schools, that they become an engine for sustainability. That's, you invest in the schools, and the schools buy locally and support the farmers who are taking care of the land. I mean, and they come in and support the school, just the way that the farmers have become part of, and the ranchers and the dairy people and the fishermen are all very good friends of the community of my restaurant. And this is what can happen, and it's happened in a very short period of time. I can remember the time, that... And this all began, and this food system has only changed in the course of my lifetime. Back at World War II, we had a pure source of food. We bought from the people who were growing it and making it. And this has only happened in that period of time. So I think we can change back.
Thank you. And I'm going to read the first question, and then I'm going to answer it. And I'm the moderator. I get to do that. The question is it fair to require menu labeling at chain restaurants only, not at all restaurants like Chez Panisse? There is clearly someone from the Burger King Corporation here, and I will answer your question. The difference between Chez Panisse is that food is made from scratch each evening in the restaurant, and it may vary night to night. The effort to require menu labeling only applies to chain restaurants where the food is largely manufactured at enormous factories in standardized portions that almost have nothing to do with the kind of food you would make in your own kitchen. So menu labeling is being imposed on companies that are selling industrial food that are largely responsible for the obesity epidemic, not being imposed on real chefs making real food. So that's my answer to that question. The next question I'm going to throw over to Anya, though, and this is a critical question, but I think it's one very important to address. Isn't slow food ultimately an elitist concept, since it's more expensive to produce? Fast food may be unhealthy, but it's cheap. And basically, how would you bring slow food to ordinary working people?
And I want to just echo what Alice just said earlier around all of these changes have happened within the past 40 or 50 years. And at the time of the Second World War and shortly thereafter, to have a garden was usually a sign of low socioeconomic status, not high socioeconomic status. Isn't it funny how that has flipped around so quickly? And, you know, also to speak to Harold's point, there has been an enormous amount of marketing dollars behind getting people to perceive how their relationship with food should be and what they should think of different types of food. And I always think about how interesting it is when we see a candidate on the political trail when they want to show how really connected to the common American they are, they'll go to a Burger King or they'll go to McDonald's and eat food with all of us, right? And that type of statement, I think, really speaks to the fact that fast food has been branded as something that is the common food of every American. And really, that's been a very concerted marketing campaign, and I think we need to really push back as a food movement against that and say the sort of characterization of elitism is also the result of a strategy. And the fact that slow food is characterized as elite, if you go to South America, Central America, much of Europe, it's quite the opposite way around. And I lived for years in Sicily and in northern Italy, and the thing that shocked me the most in my first experiences there was that the poorer you were, the better you ate. And it just turned my world upside down. Because I had never seen that before, that when you didn't have very much money, you soaked your own beans, you ate with your grandmother, you gardened with your family. And those are both the areas I lived in, areas in rapidly industrializing areas. And so I saw that changing in the time that I lived there. And so I think I feel like I've seen America in the 1940s and 50s and seen those choices and those changes happening. And I think that we need to really think critically about when we characterize slow food or slow food values or eating locally as being privileges of the elite, well, actually, that's a pretty recent phenomenon, and actually, that's also something that we can really re-own. And frankly, there's been some interesting work, I think, showing Kaiser did it, showing the price of certain packaged foods compared to making those same foods off to the farmer's market if you buy the products in season. And so if you really want to get into the numbers, I think there's plenty of things that show that at times it can be less expensive. But kind of leads into my second answer or discussion point in this. In 1940, 1950s, we spent 30 to 40% of our income on food. We currently spend 8 to 9% of our income on food. There is kind of a big, ugly fact that we need to confront, which is that, you know what, we kind of need to probably spend some more money on food. We probably also need to spend a lot more time on food and a little more money. And that type of cultural shift just has to do with how much respect and how much time do you pay to food. I do think that we need to, as Slow Food, be frank about the fact that most of our kind of requests to people in the long term do involve them perhaps spending a bit more money on food. There's plenty of ways to get around it, though, by spending a lot more time. And so that would be my second answer there, is really thinking about what are your priorities. Now we want a new cell phone every year, and we spend $400 on it, and maybe that's something that we would deprioritize because we're thinking about other priorities in our budgets.
Yeah, and it's also important to keep in mind that the very unhealthy food is being greatly subsidized by the government, whereas the fruits and vegetables we should be eating aren't being subsidized the same way. And, you know, the fast food industry spends $2 billion a year on TV advertising, and the slow food movement spends a little less than that. Okay, I'm just going to read this. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Tonight we're discussing how we eat and the consequences. Joining us in this discussion are Alice Waters, founder of the Chez Panisse restaurant, Anya Furneaux, executive director of Slow Food Nation, Harold Goldstein, executive director of the California Center for Public Health Advocacy, and Dr. Bertram Lubin, president of the Children's Hospital Oakland Research Institute. And I'm Eric Schlosser, the author of Fast Food Nation. Alice.
Well, I just wanted to say something else about the price of food and how we're going to find affordable food to feed ourselves. And when we eat that fast food, we're eating the values of that fast food. And it's telling us that food should be cheap. And it's telling us that advertising confers value. And that standardization is more important than quality. And that kitchen work is drudgery. This is what is being said. And so we're eating those ideas, those values. And so we have to come to the idea, to slow food values, and we have to understand that food is something very precious. It's not something that is sort of after, as you said, the Nike shoes and the cell phones and the cars and whatever else we decide we're going to spend our money on. It should be way up there. And we either pay up front or we pay out back. And I'm suggesting that we pay up front in the public school system and feed every single child who goes to school from kindergarten all the way through high school. That's it. Right.
Harold, there's a question here. How can we get physical education as well back into the school system? And how can the public health community work towards that goal?
Great question. It's not only are we moving toward slow food nation, but we have a very slow, non-physically active nation as well. So we got to flip it around the other side. So after, I think it was 6 or 7 years of a whole lot of us working to pass those public policies on getting soda and junk food out of schools, the next obvious place to work was this whole issue of physical activity. And the large majority or large numbers of students in California public schools that aren't getting the physical activity that's already required by law. There is a law on the books that says kids in elementary school need to get 200 minutes of physical activity, physical education every 10 days, 20 minutes a day, and middle school, 40 minutes a day. Those laws are not being enforced. So Governor Schwarzenegger, to his credit, took that issue on, and we worked to, for the first time, get funding for physical education, specifically for physical education, in the state budget, $40 million a year. We guess that that's about 10% of the money that's needed to get really high-quality physical activity in the schools, where the students have teachers that are trained to be PE teachers, and they have smaller class sizes and all the rest. So a lot of what's required to get physical education in the schools is going to mean a little bit more money. And so there's the question, where can that money come from? And I think that's really one of the big public policy questions on the table today is, will the state find a way to fund all of these kinds of programs that are needed? Physical education in the schools, the kind of high-quality food programs in the schools that Alice is such an advocate for. These are things that require additional funding. So in addition to changes, again, in our own personal eating habits, I'd like to suggest that perhaps an even bigger change is the food priorities and physical activity priorities of our elected officials. And in a participatory democracy, those elected officials respond to us. And so it's about getting our message to our elected officials that says, we want these changes for our kids so that those obesity rates can start coming down.
Great. Bert, there's a question about how, once a child is obese, how likely is it that they will continue to be obese for the rest of his or her life? And this is important when it comes to Alice's programs in the schools. I mean, once a child enters one of your clinics, not in terms of that individual, but as a group, what are their prospects?
So first of all, we don't even have one of those programs now because it couldn't afford itself, because we couldn't get enough money reimbursed by seeing people to take care of these children. This is a tragedy. And I want to just try to add something onto Harold's before I try to address your question. And that is, if we looked at the economics of the consequences that occur, we would save money by putting more into food in schools, education in schools, and exercise programs in schools. If we look at the cost of the diabetes, hypertension, all of the secondary effects of obesity in children, we would, by preventing those, by doing the things that Alex is talking about and Harold's talking about, we would change this whole dynamic and we'd probably save money in the process. So we have to have elected officials who think about those kinds of things and gather numbers so that they can really document that this not only is a health benefit, but has an economic benefit for our society. Now, the second question, the question that you asked me, which was about how reversible is this, extremely difficult, long-term, very, very difficult to establish. And now there's even data that would support that nutrition during pregnancy programs a fetus to subsequent development of obesity, diabetes, and hypertension. So if you really want to do something, you have to even think earlier. You have to think during fetal life and what the long-term impact. And I think Alice's concept of education and early in the schools is critical. We have a program in East Oakland for education in grade school, third and fourth graders, about nutrition. What we find is that the third and fourth graders educate their parents, and then we bring parents in as well. So there's some great opportunities to change the way we look at these things. And I think we're so happy that so many people were here tonight, obviously interested in hearing about this, and hope that you all contribute to this change.
Thank you. Alice, there's a question here that instead of the food culture of France, could you have been inspired by visiting the Amish countryside in Pennsylvania? And have you looked at their relationship to fresh food and preparation?
I have not, but I could have easily been inspired by any of the cultures who live close to the land and at that particular time. I think a lot of people did have that connection, both to the table and to the land. And I think that's what's most important, that it's not that food isn't out in sort of no man's land. The really difficult problem we have is that we don't have these, well, we certainly don't have ecological roots, but we don't have deep gastronomic roots. And so when, you know, somebody's trying to sell us something, changing our lives, we have very little resistance. We came to this country to be part of a melting pot and not to really continue with the rituals that we had at home. And it's, I just see that whole generation, particularly the parents in the 50s and the 60s, they just didn't want to have anything to do with what was going on in the old country. They wanted to live a different way. They wanted to live with you know, this American life. And it's very sad, as Carlo Petrini says. What is his wonderful line, Nanya?
About
the gastronome.
The gastronome. So the concept is that you have the gloomy ecologist and the joyful gastronome, and never the twain shall meet. And that's one of the goals, is to bring those two sides together.
Anya, I have a question for you about the relationship between the slow food movement and vegetarianism. And does the slow food movement take into account the environmental, health, or spiritual costs of eating meat, and how do we create a food system that incorporates meat and deals with some of the consequences of eating meat?
Slow food doesn't directly address vegetarianism as a way to sort of go slow, but I think that it's inherent in a lot of the messages around slow food. By eating sustainably, that implies eating less meat than we currently eat, and you know, looking at more traditional diets and traditional approaches to food as inspiration. Most of those inspirations involve food, meat more as a condiment than as a main course. So I think there's a lot to that. I think the closest kind of synergy that we'd see with the broader kind of vegetarian movement and the slow food movement would be really around the knowing the provenance of your food and ensuring that it is respectful of the environment in its production. And so I see that as being a real common ground with vegetarianism. And I know a lot of vegetarians that are that say, I'll eat meat if I know the farmer. And maybe that isn't classic for me. It's a particular type of vegetarian that I know. But I do definitely see a lot of commonality there, because most people also turn away from meat when they read about the hormones, read about the effect on water, read about the contamination, air quality problems, all the different things linked to feedlot production, and it's a political choice. And so choosing better meat is a big campaign for slow food, and so that really does also link together with the political goals of many vegetarian organizations.
Thanks. Harold, the typical American family is really being squeezed right now, and ideally would love to spend time preparing food, and yet with both parents working and incomes declining, this is a difficult proposition. And I guess the question is, how do we get a good, safe, nutritious food into low-income communities and into the communities of ordinary working people? And what changes do we need to make so that that food is accessible and affordable?
Yeah, I think that really is the question of the day. To the extent to which we can, in our personal lives, make those changes that we want to make, that's terrific. That's the personal responsibility side of things. On the other side, we all make our food choices in the context of the world that we live in, and all too often, especially in low-income communities, but not only in low-income communities, the environment that we're living in is loaded with marketing messages that are saying, eat these very sweet, high-fat, large portion foods, and don't even have available in them the kinds of locally grown fresh produce that we're talking about tonight. And so that's really one of the big policy questions on the table. We've sponsored legislation for the past couple of years to provide funding to create innovative retail-based strategies to bring more fruits and vegetables into low-income areas. I mean, I've been to produce markets in neighborhoods that are packed, filled with absolutely delicious-looking fruits and vegetables, where the market itself is filled every time I go. And I say to myself, why doesn't every neighborhood have one of these, right? So it's a question, how do we, A, bring those retailers in, and B, support them? And if, you know, if there are public policies that are needed to do that, we absolutely need to do it. But it could also be farmers markets. It could be CSA baskets. There are a lot of different ways to bring healthy food into communities. We just need to make that a priority, and it needs to be our priority, and we need to get that message to policymakers so that we can change the environment in which so many of us are living.
Alice, this one's for you. If you could create a healthy fast food restaurant,
what would it look like?
What would it serve?
Would we be eating? Well, I just think I'd have a big garden around, and I'd give you a bottle of olive oil and say, go outside and graze.
But I'd
really like to just say something else about these vegetable markets that are available that have big piles of fruits and vegetables all year long. I have been in a lot of those stores, and when you're looking for what is really what Slow Food calls good, clean, and fair, there are very few fruits and vegetables that meet that requirement unless you go directly to the farmer's market and you can ask those questions. Because these foods that are coming into those markets are coming from all around the world. And they may be coming from factory farms and from God knows where. And we don't know what's in them. We don't know how they're grown. We don't know how the people are treated who produce that food. And so that's why we need a criteria. And it's just not getting, yes, it's better than no fruits and vegetables, but I think we have to have the bar much higher than that. And we say we want really good-tasting, seasonally ripe vegetables and fruits, and we want them to be grown without pesticides and herbicides, and we want grass-fed beef. I mean, I don't know the statistics, but maybe you do, or you do, about the factory-farmed beef and its contribution to global warming.
Big.
Big. I mean, like really big. I mean, it's if you just stopped eating meat for one day, I think it was Michael Pollan who said that's worth 500,000 hybrid cars off the road. So, I mean, it's something so important that we ask those questions and support the people who are really thinking about our own nutrition and thinking about the health of this planet. And that's what we want to get to. That's what we want to bring in people into that connection with their food.
Bert, it seems like we have a very perverse relationship towards food in this country. Among the upper middle children of the upper middle class, there's an epidemic of eating disorders and body images in the mass media that are leading young men and young women to starve themselves. And it seems as though the problem among the poor and working people is more one of obesity. How much do you see this being a class-based problem increasingly, and how much is obesity becoming a signifier of being poor in America?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I don't think we really have an enormous amount of data on that right now. But I think it's not just class. I think we do see more there because of the problems of access to food that we've mentioned, access to exercise, access to opportunities in a lower socioeconomic group. But we see an enormous amount of obesity in middle and upper class as well. In fact, programs that can afford themselves are set up in wealthy neighborhoods. Mm. And so there are opportunities to go somewhere for medical care if you have the funds to pay for it. But if you don't, and you're lower socioeconomic groups and are obese, you're in major trouble in this society. Mm. That has to change.
Mm. Anya, you have traveled widely. And in terms of other cultures, this is one of the questions here, in terms of other cultures, indigenous cultures and their relationships to food? Is there one that you can hold up as a model, not necessarily where the food tastes best, but where it seems like the consumption and production and culture surrounding food are all somehow in harmony?
Well, I mentioned northern Sweden earlier because that is that place for me. And it's funny because it's such a very, very narrow spectrum of foods, and that's what I found to be so amazing about it. In my first experience visiting Sami people, what I was greeted by when I walked into the place where we were eating, which was the first experience I had, was people singing outside in the snow and around a big fire with a pot of soup. And they gave me a cup full of this really hot broth. It's, of course, northern Sweden, freezing cold. And the soup was so, so warming. And it was made entirely just out of lean reindeer meat and salt and nothing else. And then we went inside to the meal, and it was just all gathered, simple, amazing foods. And when you talk to the food people about their food culture, A, it was very interesting to me because there's a lot of pressure for change in that community, but also the joy that they talked about the seasons with was just so amazing to me. And you think now getting people to think about what it means to not eat tomatoes for a few months of the year, think about the joy when you do get to eat them. Don't think about the denial. Think about the wonderful expectation. And that was just such a great thing to hear in their stories, was the anticipation and the love for that rhythm and for the seasons. And the other thing that just really struck me about the relationship, of course, also the link into music and songs about food. And so they actually, there's a whole category of songs that they sing that they only sing to their reindeer. And I don't want to give an example that is so obscure that it doesn't give any relevance, but just one more piece about it. You know, there's these enormous migrations, and you'll see also in much of Europe in the transhumans, where the traditional walks that you take with your animals seasonally to different pastures, and their walks with the reindeers would be, you know, literally hundreds of miles, and would involve like crossing fjords in a boat following the herd. And that rhythm and the seasons, and also the deprivation and the joy associated with it, the rituals around leaving for that journey and coming back, to me it was sort of the most incredible poetry in a single place. Ironically, the food was perhaps one of my least favorite in terms of it's a lot of reindeer, but it was amazing to see that connection. It was the only place that I've been where the relationship to food, also people just spent really all of their time being in such an extremely northern environment, dedicated to finding the food, procuring it, and it was just amazing to see. You know, and then thinking about how does that generalize, and how does that, you know, I want to take the one little piece around music, and the role of singing and dance and sharing cultural traditions about music is just so important and so far away from where we are in American food culture that I think it's a good thing to think about. Of, you know, think about agriculture and how do we put the culture back into agriculture. And I love the way that thinking, encouraging Americans to think about how every traditional culture has a whole series of rituals and dances and music, means it's so important. It's as important to be a ballet dancer or the principal in the orchestra to be an artisan in a food culture. And that's a big step that we need to take, is to reinvigorate those professions, re-honor them, make them the thing that you want to do when you graduate from high school or from college, and to bring dignity to that. And that's a huge role that I think sort of that intersection between the arts and food culture really plays in what we can learn from traditional cultures.
That's great. Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question. And I will pose it, and there's about a minute for each of you to answer it. And that would be, what would you like to see 5 years from now? On these issues, what specific concrete change would you like to see in America 2014? Anya?
I would think of it around individual consumer changes, individual Americans, and I'd want to see more people growing gardens, more people cooking, more people breaking bread with their families, more people celebrating food, more people enjoying food, teaching their children to honor food, and changing their habits to also create a better environment in California and America.
Great. And Harold?
I'd add on to that and say I'd love to see double or triple or quadruple the number of people who are actively involved in the political process in one form or another. For those of you here today, those of you listening on the radio, if you're inspired by what you're hearing today, get involved. Choose an organization that's involved in changing public policy and get involved too. Volunteer, make calls to legislators, donate funds, whatever piece that you can do, because the kind of change that we're all talking about here, whether it's Alice's piece or Anya's piece or passing statewide legislation in California to have menu labeling, it can be done, and it's going to be done when more and more people are involved and making their voice heard in the political process.
Bert?
So I, as a pediatrician, and you probably know how I'm going to answer this, but I think our strategy should be for prevention and to combine all these things in preventive strategies that give every child the opportunity to have a healthy life.
Alice?
Well, I'd like to see a vegetable garden on the White House lawn.
And I'd just like to say that I'd like the next president to stand up the way that Kennedy did back in the 60s when he said that we needed to put physical fitness into the public school system. And by his rhetoric and by his example, he was able to convince us that we needed to rebuild our schools and add gymnasiums, and every kid had to take PE, and they got graded for taking it. It was part of the core curriculum in this country. So I'm hoping that our next president will stand up for edible education, and it will be part of the core curriculum in every school in this country.
Terrific. And I would like everything you just said to come true. So I want to thank our panelists, Alice Waters, founder of Chez Panisse Restaurant, Anya Furneaux, executive director of Slow Food Nation, Harold Goldstein, executive director of the California Center for Public Health Advocacy, and Dr. Bertram Lubin, president of the Children's Hospital Oakland Research Institute. We also want to thank our audiences here and on the radio. This program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Food Lit series, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation, and it's been the kickoff event to the Commonwealth Club's month-long How We Eat platform series. I'm Eric Schlosser, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
That's it for me, though.